A view of escape. Barreto's camera frames a locker. We see three iterations of the name Donna. One within a pink heart, two on a sparkly background surrounded by stars, three on the background of a sparkling star. Conclusion? This could well be Donna's locker. And Donna is someone who wants to shine. But as the camera pans down, we see that's not all she wants to do. Various aspirational messages are affixed to the surface. One, teamwork is not a solo sport. Two, go hard or go home. Three, when the going gets tough, the tough gets going. A saying which Billy Ocean turned into a truly uplifting song. Note, and other of his hits, Get Out of My Dreams, Get Into My Car, is one of the few pop songs which correctly contends that without reliable transportation, there can be no romance. Four, the ship moves when everyone pulls an oar. Five, kindness is contagious. Six, there is no I in team. Two things are apparent. Firstly, Donna Jenton has no fear of cliché. Secondly, at the end of the day, Donna Jenton is a pack animal. She believes in the value of the collective over the individual. She prizes loyalty, joint responsibility, and, in a way that's truly refreshing, literalism. As the camera finishes its tilt, a male hand enters the frame, using a novelty magnet to affix an envelope bearing the legend Donna to the locker door. We cut wide to reveal Donna Jenton walking into what looks like a small changing room. We see that the locker is one of a row, and that the hand belongs to Tommy the Tongue Boulay. Behind Boulay's shoulder is a small sink, the kind of sink you and I might wash our hands in, or our private parts. But Boulay's hands are covered in blood. Bad blood. The kind of blood Taylor Swift hates. By the way, on the subject of bad blood, that's one of the great pop-based rebuttals to the ludicrous notion of forgiveness. Jenton's first line of the scene, I caught you, is, like so many in the film, loaded. Boulay is reluctant to let her read the contents of the envelope and secretes it in his back pocket. Donna flirtatiously retrieves the item and opens it. It's a birthday card. But when she reads the message contained within, her face crumples like a drained can of Fanta under a Cuban heel. Barreto resists the temptation to cut to one of his statement insert shots, and instead lets this moment play on Paltrow's harrowed face. Tommy Boulay is breaking up with Donna Jenton. Donna can't believe that Boulay would break off intimacy with a birthday card. Displaying a disingenuousness that will guarantee he no longer participates in the narrative, Boulay flippantly says that it's because they don't make breaking up cards. Evil. Thy name is Boulay. We know by now that Donna takes birthdays very seriously. They're an opportunity for her to take stock of her dreams, get rid of any balloons that might be holding her back, and use her internal monologue to tell us what she wants to do next. So the news that Boulay and his new paramour are leaving to pursue business opportunities in Arizona would be enough to crush her were she made of lesser stuff. Donna balefully asks whether Boulay's undisclosed co-conspirator is Linda from Lawn Chairs, before Boulay admits that it's Brenda in Barbecues. This exchange feels like a rare misstep and seems to veer from the reality so carefully established thus far. While the badinage is undoubtedly witty, this is an Eric Wold screenplay, are we to believe that people are only hired at Big Lots for their alliterative potential? Why then isn't Donna in dinnerware or at the denim bar? Also, unless Boulay's been held back for reasons of academic underperformance, a high school quarterback is unlikely to be older than 17 or 18, pretty young to land an assistant manager gig. So why is he so impatient to move on? Donna is clearly much older, so her restlessness is understandable. Indeed, it seems odd that given their obvious age difference, she would expect him to commit so soon. Did they ever talk about their relationship goals together? Or is she falling into a paradigm of passivity, perhaps reflecting the helplessness of her windy childhood? Then Boulay takes the subtext from just below the surface and hauls it up on deck. He tells Donna that she's just a small-town girl, that she belongs here, and that business is business. It is one of the strengths of the screenplay that if ever there's a chance of thematic ambiguity, someone will verbally intervene and, bluntly, restate the theme. The phrase, business is business, will haunt us later. It's a phrase that's hard to refute, much like the phrase, genocide is genocide. But the trauma of this rejection will lead Donna to harden up and focus on her own business. Business that will take her far away from Silver Springs. Business that will take her to business class and beyond. But in the short term, Donna goes to a bar. The depressed protagonist at rock bottom in a bar is a potentially overused motif, but it's familiar for a reason. It's a cave-like setting in which the wounded animal that is man or woman retreats, regroups, and reassesses, often in the company of a sympathetic supporting character who likes to obsessively dry-wipe glassware. It speaks to the archetypical story of Jonah and the whale. And if you've ever been to a Wetherspoons, you'll know exactly what it feels like to be in a whale's mouth. Except no one could stay in a Wetherspoons for 3 days and get out alive, let alone prophesy the destruction of Nineveh. The floor in many Wetherspoons is even stickier than a giant tongue, and the smell's somewhat more briny. But being in a movie bar allows an opportunity that's rare inside a whale, the chance for the camera to slowly move towards you while you have a revelatory thought. In this scene, the thought arrives via a television screen. Donna sees a talk show featuring Sally Weston, Candice Bergen, an ex-flight attendant turned lifestyle guru who is promoting her book, My Life in the Sky. She is described as a little girl from Texas who went on to become the most famous flight attendant in the world. We do not pause to ask, how did she become famous? We take the statement on trust, just like the child who has to trust us when we tell him or her we're too tired to go in goal at the moment and that it would be even more fun for him or her to keep kicking the ball against the wall. Were we to think about whether we know of any famous flight attendants, we might rob ourselves of the opportunity to enjoy the narrative. There are famous people who used to be flight attendants, but the most likely way to become famous as a flight attendant is to hijack the plane. And it was a plane hijack that stopped View from the Top from being released in 2001. The studio heads felt that, in the aftermath of the most destructive terrorist attack to occur on US soil, a film making light of being a flight attendant would be inappropriate. Such was their urge to honour the victims of 9/11 that they didn't feel it would be respectful to recoup their investment until the fuss had died down. They also took the opportunity to return to the editing room and revisit the film in the light of the tragedy. Perhaps it was the moving images of firefighters and civilians joining together to sift through the wreckage and attend to the injured that gave them the idea to include a pre-credits blooper reel as a tribute to what was lost. Meanwhile, back on the fake TV talk show, Sally Weston starts to say some things that are uncannily pertinent to Donna's situation. People told Weston that she was nothing and that she would never amount to anything. Then she realized that her dreams were not waiting down there, gesture. They were waiting up there, gesture. As well as positing the notion that dreams have heights, Weston is insistent that you can be whatever you want, regardless of background. But, she adds for reasons that are hard to fathom, you have to start right now. Weston is calling on Donna and us to believe that complete personal transformation is an act of will. Here the film seems to be in dialogue with the work of Terrence Malick and his perennial examination of a post-exilic world in which nature vies with grace. What can woe man achieve through works versus what is given? Do we choose to love, as the t-shirts tell us, or must we love? If we have not love, have we life? You certainly need to send fewer Christmas cards. In Top, as in Malick's lesser Tree of Life, works is symbolized by career, grace by family. This is Donna Jensen's struggle, though in many ways the film is a struggle in its own right. You have to start now. The question hangs in the air, as challenging as a debate on Channel 4 News. Donna stands up, walks towards the bar, and steps into one of Barretto's loving close-ups. But how? She asks, helpfully making exterior a thought that acting alone might not convey. Sally Weston seems to look at Donna, and by so doing, at us. Her answer? You've got to buy my book. We don't need to see Donna buy the book. The act of purchase is implied when Barreto cuts to her reading it. Pure Eisenstein. A third meaning created by the juxtaposition of two shots. Thesis, antithesis, synthesis. Bravo, Barreto. A flurry of telling inserts follow. 1. Donna's hands pull open a drawer. 2. Donna's hands pick up some clothes from the drawer. 3. Camera pans to an open holdall. 4. Donna's hands zip the holdall shut. Insert shot, a newspaper on the classified page. 6. Donna's hands toss the holdall into the open trunk of a car. 7. Close shot, Donna's hands turn key with fun fob in the ignition of a car. 8. Donna's hands yank down the gear lever. It's both a great piece of filmmaking and a red-letter day for Paltrow's hand double. This dizzying montage concludes with the money shot. Donna's smiling yet determined face. Her journey has begun.